Welcome and thank you all for coming. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS, and we've got a great program here today. We're going to keep this discussion in a sort of conversational and informal style, and we're going to invite all of you to sort of join in. Let me offer a few introductory remarks. First of all, I want to thank Kate Hoffler from CSIS for getting us all here today and getting the word out and coordinating with Simon and Schuster. And with Johnny, Julia Prosser and Nicole DiGiacomo from Simon & Schuster were very cooperative and very helpful in pulling this together. This is many of you probably haven't had a chance to read Johnny's work over the years. My first exposure was reading Midlands, which you put out earlier in the decade, 2002, which is an account of a murder KwaZulu-Natal, and I found it hauntingly sort of beautiful and difficult to sort of get through and understand, because it was yet another of these very complex and obtuse sort of realities that you were trying to sort of bring across. And it was, it was both very compassionate and very analytic, and I had a chance to read some of the earlier the component parts that came together in your book on the policing, and you know, the sort of themes that run through all of this work around crime and justice and a sense of history that people bring to behavior and trying to unpack these mysterious unintended kind of outcomes or behavioral outcomes that seem counterintuitive. And to make sense of these, it runs through all of these works. And when this came out, I was delighted that you brought it to our attention and that we had a chance to get you here today to talk about it. I was also delighted that Simon Schuster seemed to be showing such a serious effort at getting it out. I was at Stanford last week, which I know is where one of the places you're going to be speaking next week. And the borders there and on the university and the edge of the university had a nice fresh pile as you walk in, so there's somebody's thinking that you're coming there. They're busy about that. This is a beautifully written, very powerful and compassionate book, and very personal in a way, particularly in the concluding section, in the way that you draw your own life into this, and I hope we'll hear more about that. And also, it's very, I think the narrative that you present. You start out with this big question around why would people choose consciously to raise the risk of early death over a greater sense of confidence that you could endure, and why would people shun the option for life-sustaining therapy as sort of your starting point in this. It then leads you into what I thought were very compelling portraits of personalities, and Sizwe is obviously the sort of the major personality, but there are other big personalities there. Herman Reuter, Kate Morandi, and many other less major figures, but who are woven into this story also in a very powerful way. I think for us here, for an American audience, this was something that we talked about earlier when you first brought this to our attention, trying to figure out how this connects to what we think about here in the United States, where HIV, AIDS, and Africa has become a big issue. And maybe we can talk a bit more about this, but one is just the gaps in our knowledge. I think this book helps us in a humbling sort of way, because the realities on the ground with respect to stigma and shame and sex and history and how all that ties together to individual choices and to prevention strategies, much of that is simply absent in the discussions that happen here in Washington. The discussions here in Washington are much more truncated and simplistic in a way. And one of the things we've attempted to do over the last 6 or 7 years is bring people forward to a Washington audience who speak with a sort of ground-level reality around this. And I think what we've discovered is there's an enormous appetite for this, but less in the kind of narrative work that you've done or the work that Helen has done, Epstein, in her book. But we've mostly been bringing here people who are practitioners and operational and policymakers to speak, and there is a great appetite for that. I think it's important that we take a less simplistic view of President Mbeki, not less critical, but less simplistic. There's, in the American domain, not only is there an overly simplistic view of prevention, and it's reduced to this ABC formula, and that's how we debate, and we've tried to force a much larger debate around prevention and what it means. But there's a very sort of simplistic thumbnail sort of set of conclusions about Mbeki and what drives him, and is he alone in being a lunatic, or is it fair to even say that he's a lunatic? And is this something that is much more nuanced and requires a much greater understanding? We're here we're at an important moment here in the United States around HIV/AIDS. I mean, we had the president's trip just this week, just concluded today. Questions raised around prevention, around the U.S. strategy. It was quite important, I think, in some respects, that the contribution the United States made was acknowledged in a significant way at many of those stops. But people were also quite vocal, and deferential but vocal, in bringing across their critiques of our approach. And there was a willingness, a demonstrable willingness on the part of President Bush to listen in a sort of, so there was less defensiveness in the response than I would have expected, in a way. And part of that is because we're in the middle of our own debate here. We're getting to the end of the first five-year discussion, our commitment on PEPFAR and the President's emergency plan. We're revisiting these big issues around prevention. There's draft legislation on the Hill. It's turning out in some ways to be very polarizing, because I don't know if you've seen some of the draft legislation, but it's 120 pages long. It's coming from the Democratic side. A lot of criticism lodged at some of this. But it's attempting to put forward a different, what we have we learned in the last several years? And there's a shared sense in the United States that what we have done in terms of U.S. commitments is terribly important and has to be sustained and informed, but we have to prepare for the uncertainties and the counterintuitive outcomes, and for dealing with a much more complex set of realities than we've been prepared to acknowledge now. And I think in that context, your book is going to, at least in a Washington context, people are going to be eager to sort of read it and think about it, and it's directly relevant to what we're doing here. I think for a lot of Americans, outside of a sort of immediate policy debate, some of whom, you know, you'll see on campuses, strong interest in HIV/AIDS and global infectious disease, but it's going to be a more general sort of interest in finding out what this says to an American public about this. And maybe you've made an effort to connect it to the earlier gay experiences at the early part of the epidemic in the United States, and that was a searing experience. I'm not sure how many people are aware of that experience here. It may require sort of bringing that forward in a fashion. Okay, Johnny, why don't we still, we want to try and keep this more interactive and informal. Why don't you start out by just reflecting a little bit on the overall kind of genesis and outcome of this book. I mean, you started out with a very broad idea, and then it evolved into this very intimate and extended relationship, particularly with Sizwe. As you look back on this, what was the, you know, how do you look back upon this phase in your life and the surprises that came with this kind of enterprise when you start from this kind of project? What were the main revelations that sort of came to you in the course of this? I know that's a very broad way, but I wanted to sort of step back for a moment, and you know, you've got a little bit of distance between going through all of this and completing this. What are your reflections today on it?
Well, let me go back one step earlier, and for those who haven't read the book, just give a brief synopsis of what it's about. I had the idea to write the book when reading another book, Edwin Cameron's book, Witness to AIDS. He tells a story there about Botswana. In 2001, the government decides to make antiretroviral medicine universally available, first country in Africa to do so. It estimates that there are about 100,000 people in urgent and desperate need of treatments immediately. 2 years after the program begins, only 15,000 people are in treatments. The other 85,000 and now more are dying or dead. And Cameron's answer to why is shame and stigma, that people chose to stay at home and die rather than to come out with this virus, which struck me as an extraordinary story and you know, really stuck in my mind. And I went to look for a treatment site in South Africa that was working. I wanted a poor rural area, but where treatment was good, and to go there and see what was going on, if the same thing was happening, and if not, why not? So it was about people's relation to treatments, and I chose Lusikisiki. 150,000 people, densely populated, very, very poor, very rural, and what set it apart from many other areas in the country like it was that MSF, Doctors Without Borders, had started a wonderful treatment program there, and for most of those 150,000 people, treatment was within walking distance. I met a young man who I've called Sizwe Magadla, who at first I employed really as a guide to the area, firstly for language. I don't speak Xhosa very well. And secondly, just to interpret what was going on. He was a kind of translator, guide, interpreter. And the book ended up being about him. He's the person I got closest to, the person I understood best. You know, in these situations, one's guide often becomes one's subject. And he really posed what to me was a conundrum, which became the book's conundrum. He was a very successful young man. He was 29 years old. He was charismatic. He was good looking. He was well liked, and he was successful. He was running a shop in his village and making money, which set him apart. Most young men his age were unemployed or barely employed or very poor. He was convinced that he was HIV positive. He was healthy, but he was convinced that he felt this contamination in his blood, and yet he wouldn't test. And we went from treatment site to treatment site, and we saw the drugs working. You know, we'd see somebody initiate treatment who was skin and bone, who was riddled with skin disease, who was dying, and a month later see them again healthy. So he was seeing these drugs work, and the more he saw them work, the more he insisted that he wouldn't test. I want to know why. What in a psychologically healthy, happy human being, what's that about? So that's what the book's about, essentially. Now, to get directly to your question, I mean, there were many revelations for me. I think one revelation was where Thabo Mbeki's position comes from. When I went into this work, my assumption was that Mbeki is an oddity, and that his position on AIDS is very much that of a black English gentleman, very much in exile. A person who's lived much of his life as an outsider, as a black person in a white society, an intellectual person. I didn't think that he represented much in South Africa, and I was very, very wrong. I saw many Thabo Mbekis at village level, and one of them was Sizwe. One of them was the person I was writing about. And I think that what unites him to young men in the villages, and men in particular, is the question that obsesses him is why is the epidemic, the AIDS epidemic, uniquely terrible in Africa? What is the answer to that question? And his answer was this. His answer is that the West is telling Africa that you're sick. You're sick because you're oversexed, particularly because your men are oversexed. And we're going to save you. And he found that to be a racist assault. He found it, it produced enormous anger in him, and it fueled his denial. At a village level, men ask very similar questions. Why is the virus so bad here among black people in Africa? And their answer is also an attack, but a conspiracy. A commonly held belief is that the virus was invented in a laboratory and brought to the African continent to decimate people. And I think there's a very particular reason why it's AIDS that fuels that conspiracy, and why it particularly fuels that conspiracy among men. And it's that the virus is carried not just in the blood, but in the semen. It's something that you transmit to your children. It means that in generating yourself, you're poisoning the next generation. And there's a theme in South African masculinity which, you know, understands generations of colonization as generations of emasculation. And this seems an emasculating attack. And it also comes from an environment which has a cosmology which understands much illness as fabricated by evil intent. I found not a direct but a very, very interesting connection between what Mbeki's been saying and what's happening on the ground.
Oops, excuse me, sorry.
Turn your cell phones on.
But, you know, in the South African context, it seems to be even more intense than almost any other setting, what you're describing. This particular combination of factors that leads to a sort of a national leader and someone at the ground level in a village who's an aspiring, dynamic, smart personality sharing this. And maybe you could tell us a bit more about what it is about South Africa that makes that so acute, because we've not had nearly the same dimension in other societies that are predominantly black, that have had difficult or particularly compounded sort of colonial experiences. The South African instance seems to be special in some respects. I'm not sure you would have found the same story in countless other villages outside of South Africa. Perhaps in other Southern African states that share similar sort of racial history to it. But there's something there, and beyond that is the question of how do you supersede all of those obstacles? I mean, the book, the narrative does not lead you to despair or hope in a way at the end. It leads you with a very ambiguous conclusion as to, well, okay, we've gone through this series of encounters and revelations that bring home the reality, the complexity of shame, stigma, power relations, fear, all of these things that enter into the calculations, not just of this one man, but of a broad set of people in this village and people who are coming in and out. But the reality is that people are dying as a consequence, and the disease is there, and it's having a devastating impact, and there are people struggling to come to terms with it, and there is some progress, but there's also some enormous resistance and confusion around that. So it's really two questions I'm putting on the table. One is, how do you account for this acute and intense phenomenon in South Africa, and what's your projection forward? Where does this move us at the end?
Well, I'm not sure quite how unique South Africa is. I mean, there's certainly these issues are very acute in South Africa, but I mean the example that stimulated the book was in Botswana, you know, which clearly, you know, clearly has big issues around, you know, similar questions. So I'd hesitate to talk of some sort of exceptionalism, but I think, you know, acuteness is, you know, absolutely correct. You know, obviously one looks into history and one goes back generations, but I think that the last 15 years are very important. I think that when freedom is coupled with shrinking labor markets, and with wide-scale disease, I mean, the result is quite shattering. I think that I don't think that South African... I mean, this book's about a man, and the issues are really much about masculinity and disease. I don't think South African men were prepared to embrace freedom from a position of such weakness, and has made freedom very, very difficult to deal with. And that leads directly into your next comment and question. You know, I think the power of Helen Epstein's book is that she's correct that prevention happens when a country is able to have a national dialogue, is able to collectively reflect on what transmits a virus, what it is about individual and collective behavior that transmits a virus, and how to collectively change. And that discussion needs to be meaningful, it needs to happen at the grassroots. And in a society racked by violence, you know, one of the most violent societies in the world, where levels of solidarity are very, very thin, where bonds are very thin, that discussion is so hard. And if you look at prevention in South Africa and how difficult it's been to speak to people about sex, and particularly to speak to young men about sex, it's breaking this epidemic is hard. And you know, one's tempted to think about it metaphorically, about how South Africa deals with AIDS. One's tempted to say, if it can deal with AIDS, it can deal with everything else too. You know, dealing with the prevention side of AIDS is about whether meaningful national solidarity can be built, you know, among and between ordinary people. And if it is possible to change the set of sexual practices that are killing so many people, then the country can do a great deal. So it's not a very direct answer, but I think that you know, a lot rides on the capacity to start having that conversation and to making it meaningful. My sense is that prevention has been so hard that the way to have that conversation is through treatment. You know, treatment makes the sick visible. More than anything else South Africa has had, it produces talk and discourse at a very local level. You know, the sick literally come out of the woodwork. You see them. You see them taking their pills. You see them getting better. It makes the epidemic visible, and therefore makes it raises levels of talk about the epidemic. So I think in South Africa, the way to have that conversation is to put a huge amount of money and energy into treatment.
And do you think that South Africa is approaching some kind of threshold where, because when you look at the dollars, when you look at the, okay, there's been this lack of a national dialogue or national leadership on these issues, but when you look at the dollars that the government is committing, and then you look at the dollars that donors are committing in Southern Africa, in South Africa, Botswana, and other southern, it's an astronomical resources, and the numbers of people put on treatment are staggering. It's still 25% of need, but as against 5 years ago, the advances are astronomical, and in that way, very, very encouraging. But the data that's coming in on new incidents in Southern Africa, as against other Southern and Eastern Africa, as against other parts of the world, also remain just alarming. There is I agree with you that when you look at this, you think there has to be a path towards changing psychology and behavior and choice through the awareness that there is treatment and that you can bring the disease forward in a visible way. But we've not reached that point yet, certainly. And I think what's painful today for many people who work these issues is that there is this paradoxical reality that a massive investment has been made in treatment within Southern and Eastern Africa, and yet the prevention progress is not there yet. Which gets me to sort of, out of your book, what do you think the single sort of biggest piece of advice would be to someone thinking about prevention? I mean, our simplistic sort of debate here in the United States has been among sort of A, B, and C, although there are others who are arguing for a much broader approach. What do you think the conclusion is that you would tease out of this narrative?
Prevention in South and in Southern Africa more generally has been such a mystery. You know, it is very, very difficult stuff, and you know, what we do know is that lives can be saved through drugs. We don't know how many lives can be saved through prevention programs, because almost all of them have failed. And, you know, if resources are coming in, I think there are particular human beings here and now whose lives can be prolonged by a decade or more, and you know, there's a moral imperative to treat them. I'm kind of repeating myself, but I think that is the way to get to prevention. I think not just that it's the morally correct thing to do, I think it's the way to begin talking. And one of the things that it may do, you're right, it hasn't worked yet because new infection rates are still very, very high, and perhaps it won't work, we don't know. But perhaps one of the things that treatment can do is to begin to routinize the disease and its treatments. That may be a powerful route. I mean, at the moment, if you look at South Africans on treatment, they're probably just under 500,000 right now, and 70% of them are women, just 30% of them are men. So men are staying at home and dying in very, very large numbers. And I think treatment needs to reconsider, treatment programs need to reconsider why, and start designing programs that are going to get men into treatments. And I think that may start speaking to prevention. I think that if we can reach a point where men are sufficiently brave to come forward and take drugs, then we're talking to them about sex too. We're talking to them about prevention too. So I'm repeating myself a little, but I hear what you're saying. It's not working yet. New infections are very, very high, but I think it is the way to go.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the sort of this book side by side with Helen Epstein's, I mean, Helen was trying to get everyone to think with respect to multiple concurrent partnerships and social patterns and fear. I mean, when she was looking at Uganda, she was looking at how visible is the epidemic and its consequences, right, in terms of mass mortality associated with the disease, changed behavior. But you had a different kind of leadership. You were coming out of a war that had devastated the country. You had great fear of slipping back into a failed state. And this new threat emerged. And people did change their behavior. What I thought fascinating about your book was it didn't really argue with much of what Helen was saying, I didn't think. It added another dimension in talking about masculinity and stigma and shame and how, and in the South African context, the way in which the apartheid era had convinced people that disease was an instrument of repression and that this had created a whole set of premises around HIV/AIDS that people had underestimated for a very long time, that people just missed. They missed a whole dimension of the way people understood infectious disease within Southern Africa, and particularly in South Africa, and they missed the way that men, black men in South Africa, would view this disease. I don't know, is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I'm Scott Everts, and I think the reason Steve had me come up here is that I had the distinct privilege to serve as the first director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy under President Bush when there was no PEPFAR, when there was no Global Fund. And I had the unique opportunity just to give you some context, Johnny, which will then kind of introduce my question, which is in large part Steve's. I might try to make it a little simpler, but one of my first visitors to the White House was Justice Cameron, and you know that was quite an honor and a privilege. And shortly after that, we had this thing called the UNGAS, United Nations General Assembly Special Session on HIV/AIDS. And I led a White House delegation that was working on the Declaration of Commitment, which was an interesting exercise in and of itself. I was called down from there because President Mbeki made it as far as Washington, but not New York, for the UNGAS, which, of course, everyone was viewing as some form of a statement. But I was asked to come back to Washington to brief President Bush to tell him what to say to this guy about his opinions on HIV/AIDS. And much to my delight, the president was actually fairly forthcoming in articulating that we kind of have a different vision of both what causes AIDS and what might be the solution. And then following that, I had the opportunity to travel to South Africa basically when there was no treatment. I was in a testing facility, term used loosely, voluntary counseling and testing facility outside Matuba, and one of the things that was most striking to me is that the young woman that was testing people was explaining to our delegation the process by which they went through, and she explained how they tested individuals and talked to them about nutrition and healthy living and all that kind of stuff. And she said, but if the person does come back to get the results, because this is at the time prior to a lot of rapid tests, we had to tell them there is no treatment. And then we told them how to manage their disease, but there was no treatment. Around that same time, a line that, you know, as a politician turned policy advisor to the president, a line that got a lot of applause was the line, there is no prevention without treatment. And I think in many ways that still holds true. But what I'm hearing you say is that our perhaps naive vision as a donor country and a group of well-meaning people, that that treatment would then result in prevention, and that, you know, all we had to do is add treatment to prevention, care, and treatment, and we would solve all the ills of the developing world. You know, what I'm hearing you say and observing in my travels in Africa now is that that may not be the case. I guess it's a lot like Steve's question, but again, I'm going to simplify it. Have you actually observed notable difference, other than just the numbers of people that are on treatment, but have things changed over the past 5 years? You know, has, you know, in a, you know, beyond the number of people that are on ARVs and the amount of hope that that's brought to those number of people's lives, you know, are the things that the Global Fund and PEPFAR and all of the well-meaning donor institutions had in mind when this was developed, you know, even longer than 5 years ago, are they, do you see a more organic difference that they're making, or are we simply putting a number, you know, many more people on ARVs than before?
Well, let me answer that question very locally about Lusikisiki, and in fact about a particular village in Lusikisiki of you know, 600 or 700 people. 5 or 6 years ago, that village didn't know where the boundary of AIDS stopped and started. You know, every opportunistic infection associated with AIDS that people die of overlaps with recognizable diseases that have been there for generations. So, you know, if somebody had AIDS dementia or meningitis, it was believed that they'd been bewitched by a demon inside them. If somebody had shingles, it was believed that a magical snake had been sent. There were strong beliefs in witchcraft, and almost every a symptom of opportunistic infection associated with AIDS overlapped with a very long-held witchcraft belief. So you had a situation where there were funerals of young people every weekend, but no certainty that there was an AIDS epidemic, which was really an alarming situation. Treatment began. People were very, very wary of treatment. There were talks about conspiracies involved in treatment actually bring AIDS. But people nonetheless watched, and somebody with shingles would go to a clinic and get treated with drugs and then go on to ARVs and get better. You know, people with neurological problems too, and within months, really, the whole epidemic had been redefined and medicalized. So, just at that level, just at the level of what you know, that money spent on treatment did to the perception of the epidemic and where it starts and where it ends, and was invaluable and probably couldn't have been done in any other way. I don't know if that begins to answer.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, the other thing that I failed to mention, I was also in South Africa with our Secretary of Health and Human Services and South Africa's health minister about 2 days before the government lost the lawsuit in the prevention to mother-to-child transmission lawsuit. And, you know, that was, you know, an interesting observation because, you know, here we had something that was easy and quite visible in terms of kind of the medical model, and it was being resisted by the government. But again, you know, we felt a little bit like, you know, well, we're here and we're imposing this, and is this truly going to make a difference? Certainly in the lives of, you know, the babies that are not born with HIV, it makes a difference. But in terms of the overall mindset, I don't know that it's made a difference for the minister, but you can keep trying.
Well, the minister won't be the minister all that much longer.
Yeah.
How do you think this book is going to be received in South Africa? I mean, we're in the middle of a major transition right now. I mean, Mbeki's political career is over. It's a very uncertain phase, but we're at an uncertain succession phase now, in which people are pausing and taking account of where South Africa is. There's been a lot of discussion with the crisis in Eskom and power, with the whole succession around whether South Africans are feeling less confident in their future or in themselves, and it's an interesting period. But How do you see this book fitting, and how do you, where do you see the debate nationally going in this period?
I don't know. I mean, I've been very poor at predicting how previous books of mine would be received in South Africa. I get it wrong, you know, every time. So I'm going to wait and I'm going to wait and see. I mean, part of the motivation, the book's primarily written, you know, first and foremost for a South African audience, and, you know, coming, it's a very unequal country, and it means that the reading public has very little knowledge of the way many, many people in South Africa experience daily life. And AIDS is, it's spoken of incessantly in the media all the time, but in the very deadening, rigid jargon, which doesn't get to the fact that what's happening is interior, it's inside people's heads, it's about psychology and symbolism and culture, and, you know, what's happening in people's heads is driving what this epidemic means, and I'm hoping that you know, this book can contribute to a conversation which is about ordinary people in the grassroots, and, you know, what's the questions around race, around masculinity, around sex, that actually giving this epidemic its meaning. I don't think that we've done a very good job in getting there in South Africa.
But do you think that South Africans are ready for this type of debate now, more than they were a few years ago? Do you think that people are weary of this phase of frustration and debate of the Mbeki era and looking for some sort of renewed discussion?
Debates in South Africa are so mercurial in a way. I mean, we debate all the time, and we shout very volubly all the time, and the debates can often get swallowed up, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily change practice. There's a strange disconnect between how volubly we talk about things and how little we change. We're certainly ready to talk. We've been talking a long time. I don't know if we're ready to change. I don't know. That's the big question we keep circling here.
Yeah. There many people that look at HIV/AIDS across different countries will acknowledge that there's been problems of leadership and problems of history that come into play in the South African instance. But there's also constantly this mantra that civil society within South Africa remains much more vibrant and strong and developed than many other countries, and that is a force unto itself, and that HIV/AIDS and the empowerment of those communities will proceed in a fashion that faster and more fuller than you might see in other places. I'm not sure that that's the story that you take away from reading your book.
No, it's not.
And could you comment on that?
Look, the Treatment Action Campaign is far and away the most powerful and creative social movement that's arisen in post-apartheid South Africa, and it's arisen to demand treatment. It's about AIDS. But for all its creativity and for all its success in engaging government wonderfully, powerfully, creatively, with a wonderful spirit, what it hasn't been able to do is it has not at all been able to speak to heterosexual black men. It doesn't know how to begin to speak to them. The attack was started by various people, gay men, people in the Trotskyite faction of the old liberation movement, very, very smart people, but not mainstream people. Sort of people who find it very, very hard to engage heterosexual black men about sexual practice. If it's going to do that, it's going to have to reinvent itself. It's a very, very hard thing to do. I don't know if it can be. I don't know if the Treatment Action Campaign can, in its current form, do that, but that's its challenge. So it's a mixed bag. It's a very powerful, very creative, wonderful social movement. I don't think it's going to make many inroads into prevention as it's currently configured.
But looking at the role of women, I mean, you mentioned earlier 70% of those who are on ARVs are now women. You know, some have predicted that as treatment expanded and as other programs of care and prevention expanded, that you would see a women's movement sustained in many of these settings. Is that not happening in South Africa?
Well, the bulk of TSC's members are women, which is great, but it's a symptom of the fact that it's not talking to men. And I guess in Lusikisiki, it was, I mean, the women in that movement were extraordinary people, and their own lives had been changed in wonderful ways by treatment coming to Lusikisiki. It had changed their lives for the better. They were rural people in a very downbeat environment, and they were empowered by becoming treatment activists. They're going to be successful as a result, which is wonderful. I don't think they're well positioned to speak to the mainstream of their societies. They're regarded as a fairly marginal cult. And you know, they walk into meetings with chiefs in villages and try and engage, and that's impressive. But as long as it remains a movement of almost exclusively of young women, it's limited.
Let's open up a bit. Scott, you want to field some questions?
I think I saw Harvey.
Tony?
Yeah, in the District of Columbia, we can learn a lot about the highest incidence of the country. And it's becoming an African-American disease, and women too. And certainly there's a lot of discussion on it. My question is on political leadership. Understanding that Mbeki was extremely difficult as Minister of Health, but you had Mandela that came out, and his son died of HIV. And you look at some other countries like Brazil and Thailand and Uganda that had political leadership either from the Ministry of Health or from the elected president. We in this country suffered under President Reagan. It was 6 years before he mentioned the word HIV/AIDS, and that was 40,000 people who died. How much do you feel can political leadership affect a positive response, or have we all gone past that?
I think that political leadership is, obviously it has a very powerful role to play, but there are limits. That political leadership is going to hit a wall when political leaders can't talk about sex and can't talk about it in ways that matter. So, you know, you can have Mandela announcing that his son died of AIDS and that we must know this and it must be public. And Mangosuthu Buthelezi did the same, you know, very bravely. But there's a disconnect between that and what's causing the epidemic, you know, which Mandela and Buthelezi don't really, well, particularly Mandela can't talk about. He literally can't talk about it. And, you know, until political leadership can start speaking quite freely and engagingly with the fact that, you know, a generation of young men is not going to be employed and that their identities are entirely invested in sexual performance, and sexual performance, you know, often means multiple partners. You know, until leaders can engage very creatively with the fact that for many young women, transactional sex has become deeply embedded in the culture as a way of you know, of accumulating material goods. You know, those are the issues that political leadership must address, and it can't do it from a pulpit. It can't do it, you know, by claiming an abstract moral high ground. It's got to speak to people as they're living their lives. You know, I haven't yet come across a South African politician who can really do that.
Hi, Scott. Good to see you again. I lived in Botswana many years ago and followed with great interest Botswana to this day. Botswana has had many of the conditions that you point to as being necessary to develop a culture of prevention and knowledge. You've had leadership who's been involved on this issue for a long time, much longer than in our country. You now have a mandatory or near-mandatory testing environment with Botswana requiring that anytime you enter the health system in Botswana, you will be tested, and unless you opt out, we will give you your status. And to the surprise of many, people are electing, including men, to receive their status. So the idea that knowledge of status is perhaps one of the first steps toward developing prevention at a personal level is happening there. You have a country, and Justin Cameron hasn't continued the story, because although only 15% of the people enrolled in Botswana in treatment in the first 3 years of the program, now virtually everybody in Botswana is enrolled in treatment programs. So you have a national, for the first time, an effective and a national treatment program. But what mystifies me, and we had the president of Botswana here not long ago, and a man that we made all of us admire greatly because of his candor and willingness to take on tough issues, We are still mystified by the absence or the inability of really demonstrating success in prevention, because while there's been a flattening in the Botswana rate of HIV positive, it is perhaps attributed to a bunch of other factors, not necessarily the effectiveness of a prevention campaign. And one of the areas that we saw living there, and those of us who've lived in Southern Africa know this issue that you pointed about intergenerational or transactional sex, which is certainly a very much a strong driver of the disease, still hasn't really found its sort of roots in a sanctioning sort of way. People do not, civil society hasn't found means in which to really point to that and sanction it in sort of one way or another, saying this is really bad and dangerous behavior and it should be prevented, and civil society institutions ought to make this a more effective or make this a part of whatever they're doing. And I'm just sort of not grasping at straws here, but I'm sort of saying that this is a lot more complicated than many people thought, and a country that has many of the things that you point that South Africa might not have still has had a lot of challenges in developing a prevention program. So I guess I'm just throwing that out from experience and evaluating Botswana as closely as I do. I look forward to reading your book. I'm sorry I haven't read it before I came here.
Yeah, that's it's a frustrating story. It's a fairly bleak story, isn't it?
It is.
Laura. To follow up with the previous question, where do you see the epidemic going, considering the political leadership that's likely to take over Mbeki's?
Well, I guess it depends on who and what that political leadership is. It's not a foregone conclusion that Jacob Zuma will be the next president of South Africa. If he is, he's certainly at the level of rhetoric very committed to treatment. There's none of Mbeki's ambiguity. But I think that the very symbols and styles of the way in which Zuma has become powerful are very bad for prevention. if I said earlier that perhaps simplistically that black South African men have experienced white domination as a gradual and painful and accumulating process of emasculation, Zuma is about the emasculated fighting back. Zuma's story is of a strong man who's been wronged. That's the story he projects, and millions of men around the country identify with it very emotively and powerfully, and that's not an environment in which to be having a useful discussion about prevention. So I think that the Zuma phenomenon is not good news for the epidemic.
Zuma, I mean, would he be willing to go there?
And the second part is, to what extent either would it be possible or would it be successful to include, in addition to all the other strategies, an approach where essentially you try to put a new face on AIDS by firstly making it more open, and secondly making that face a far more ordinary person, or at least appealing to the ordinary person face, in a way that, you know, most of the other people who have been identified with their HIV positive are not. They're not everyone.
Well, on the face of it, Zuma does seem to go there. He says, I made a mistake, and I want to hold up my mistake as an example. You know, he says that all the time, almost as a mantra. But he's saying two things at the same time, really. He's very, very good at saying two things at the same time. You know, he's also telling a bunch of men who support him, I've got to say that to those people. Because then he qualifies it with something else, which is speaking to another audience. So I don't think he means it. I don't think he, yeah. Other role models, yes, of course, it's very important. It's also tricky. I mean, there's a book most of you probably won't have read. It's only published in South Africa by Liz McGregor, called about Kabzela. Kabzela was a household name, a radio journalist, a radio personality. On a black working class radio station, who was known to sleep with a lot of women and be very cool, and contracted AIDS and announced it on the radio and talked the country through having AIDS, and why he had it and what it was about. It was very powerful stuff. And then at the last minutes, he kind of seized and went into denial and went off ARVs and started to see a range of crazy entrepreneurs peddling various things that were going to save him. And the country watched him do that too. So, you know, role models, when the issue is this difficult, role models reflect as much as they inspire, really. And some of the stuff they reflect is nasty, and their lives get complicated and their messages get complicated. So, I mean, yes, I mean, role models by all means, but that you can't short-circuit the problem by having role models. They bring the problems with them. It's a hard one, and I don't have anything particularly crisp or particularly clear to say about that. I mean, there's obviously a connection between a society that's very violent and a society that sexually transmits an epidemic this quickly and in such a sustained manner. I mean, both about lacks of solidarity and violent relationships, and you know, both are partly about the pain of young men and the vulnerability of young women. But other than those broad terms, I haven't actually thought about it in more detail.
Tom.
The nearest bookstore to Lesiki Siki is 200 miles away. About 500,000 South Africans buy books out of the country of, what, 47, 48 million? So it's a small elite, and it's racially skewed. I mean, of those 500,000 people, more than half are white. So it's talking to a very narrow audience. It's talking to... I think what it does talk to is influential people. It does talk to policymakers and people in, you know, movers in politics. For a grassroots level in a rural area, firstly, it can't take a white man. I mean, that's partly TAC's problem. They're not all white, but I mean that the sort of people who inhabit and lead TAC find it difficult to, you know, to speak in this environment. They're changing slowly, but it takes black local people, and certainly in Lusikisiki there are many, and there is dialogue, but a book like this is going to, you know, impact an area like that very, very obliquely and indirectly.
Do you think there's likely to be some negative reaction from within the community, Lusikisiki, to the book?
Yeah, I think that's...
I mean, at different points in the book you suggest... Some of this may be hard to convey,
right.
And there may be, you know, Sizwe himself talks about the reaction to being too close or too divulgent.
Well, I think writing a book about a place is exercising some sort of power over it, and that does upset people. You know, particularly a place that doesn't write about itself. You know, it's in some ways regarded as a sort of a theft. And this book tries to get under the skin of a black man and deal with issues of masculinity, and that really raises ire. So yes, I mean there will be some negative reaction.
Talk for a moment about the connections that you tried to draw of the experiences of the American gay community and the community of heterosexual black men.
Well, it's interesting when I talk about it here in America, I get two very different responses. I say things worked over here. You know, reasonably early in the epidemic, the gay community took stock, and some people say nonsense. It took, you know, corpses in the streets before it happened. I think that the gay community in the 80s had two things going for it that the South African epidemic doesn't, and the one quite simply is that. In this country, it was possible reasonably quickly to medically define the epidemic very clearly. Its boundaries were very clearly defined, you know, by the early 80s, and that's much more difficult in South Africa in a context of, you know, where definition is very political, very contested, where medicine is very contested. There's a great deal of medical and philosophical pluralism. Just the process of defining the epidemic is more difficult. And the second issue is that, you know, gay American men of the 1980s generally regarded themselves as self-invented people. They weren't born with their identities. They made their identities in their late teens, or they very much regarded their identities as something that they had put together themselves. And in that sort of community, you can talk about these things. You can talk about most things, and the possibility of changing them is much greater. You know, I think things are less stuck down. You know, whereas, you know, for heterosexual black men in South Africa, your identity is very much inherited, you know, deeply so. And there are things that are not up for discussion, which were here. So I think those are two things that really make it a different task in South Africa.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of complexities to the issue of the comparison between the response and, as you say, you know, was it a success or was it not a success? I think the response, you know, there were corpses in the street, if you will, but the response to that was rather quick. And there was, within certain communities, not a whole lot of denial for the reason that you state, which is that it became known rather quickly what was causing this disease, and we didn't have, you know, those bizarre debates. What I do find kind of interesting is that, you know, having, you know, been one of those self-invented gay men in the 80s, though of a maybe particularly unique bent, Roman Catholic and Republican, so, you know, I met with my peers in a phone booth. The fact is...
In Wisconsin.
Right. The fact is, you know, there was a lot of power in that community, and in certain pockets and in places, including Wisconsin, because it had a fairly progressive view on gay rights. So that community was able to amass, you know, the political power that it did have and have an influence rather quickly on the response to the debate around the issue. It's fascinating traveling now in Africa as an adult and that self-invented gay man and to be asked, how is it that you, not you as gay man, but how do we do this? How do we, you know, arrest the epidemic the way it was in the early years in the U.S.? And that's just it's a fascinating question. It's very difficult to answer because in large part, you know, if you disclose you're a self-invented gay man in many parts of Africa, they'll stop listening to you in many cases. And there is no model, if you will, for how do you empower politically, you know, economically and all the other ways, you know, communities that are living with HIV the way the gay community did in the 80s here. So it's kind of unique. I mean, there's a lot of people co-infected, say with, you know, hepatitis C, but I've often said there are no Hep C advocates. I mean, there were HIV AIDS advocates because of the connection to anti-gay discrimination. So in many ways that, you know, the thing that was not so much a good thing is in fact, you know, the impetus behind the response to HIV AIDS in the US. So it really can't be replicated necessarily in a country where it's not impacting the same populations. That said, I just would ask you one quick question. In Helen Epstein's book, she makes a comparison between conversations she has in South Africa and Rwanda, you know, two places that I've been to, you know, a lot. And I have to agree with her. I find this the kind of matter-of-fact discussion in Rwanda where there's political leadership. I mean, President Kagame has been, and Mrs. Kagame have been quite outspoken. But it, in a way, it feels just almost like a more adult conversation in many ways that's occurring in Rwanda around HIV and HIV prevention. And you know, beyond President Kagame, I don't know that there are Rwandan role models that are spreading this message. It's just, you know, it's a matter-of-fact conversation. Do you think her comparison is a little, too specious? You know,
I think she was flummoxed by South Africa, by by how difficult it is to talk about, how messy conversation is. I think for a long time we were blinded to the huge power of race in South Africa because the movement that got rid of apartheid was non-racial, or at least on the surface, that was its cherished ideology, and as a result we thought that race was something that we could deal with. And in the end, I think that, you know, our issues of race are among the worst and the most difficult, the most painful. And I mean, part of it has to do with the way we industrialize. Part of it has to do with 4 or 5 generations of the nature of face-to-face contact between white men and black men. In so many industries and so many spheres of life, white people had their boys. Black men were referred to as boys. There was, I think, black women were sheltered from that in ways. Many aspirant black women became teachers and nurses and took their place as kind of organic leaders of black communities. I think that black men for generations experienced a kind of frontal assault, a kind of institutionalized humiliation, in ways that men in other parts of the African continent maybe didn't. And I think it's really come back and bitten us. I don't think we were prepared for how hard race is in South Africa.
Yes.
Very much so, and very much not. It's a complicated relationship. We're very enamored by American money, and we line up for it. and at the same time, the Mbeki phenomenon is reaction to the West trying to help in its particular way. I think that the relationship is very, very prone to being interpreted as a condescending one, as a racist one, as a misunderstood one. But we obviously need the West desperately. I mean, not just as donors, but as trading partners. It's a very fraught relationship.
Yes, here and here.
Johnny, I'd like to know, you mentioned that the South African media often told rigid and not very creative stories a little while ago. Some of the issues that you address in your book are issues that obviously didn't appear in the media. And why do you think that's the case? And do you think the fact that the whole debate around the Mbeki issues and what he says and what he does believe and what he doesn't believe in sort of framed the whole public debate in such a way that the real issues didn't get discussed, in the sense that it's immature, that the way that Helen Epstein refers to it?
Well, I just think that journalism is poor in South Africa. It's particularly poor. Newspapers are run on shoestrings. Talented people go elsewhere generally, obviously many exceptions. A talented person in a newspaper is so constrained, isn't given the time to write a good story on AIDS, and even if they're desperate to, it's a very, very weak industry, and it's declined quite rapidly in the last few years. So I don't think there's any deep meaning to why newspapers write badly about AIDS. I think they write badly about everything.
Thanks. I'm reminded of a story from my own field work many years ago, of a shop steward, a self-made, invented man, not in terms of his sexuality, but in many other aspects of power, who was responding to the then comrades in township civic organizations who were attempting to usurp power of the state by adjudicating a number of different contentious issues in their own areas, their own townships. And they ventured into the realm of adjudicating conflicts between men and women. And I remember the shop steward responding to this very negatively to me, saying, "No comrade is going to tell me when I can beat my wife." And I was stunned by this connection, combination of a new man, a socialist, an advocate of transformation in South Africa, speaking very clearly about, speaking not about, but evincing the deep prejudices that I think continue to this day. What was stunning as well is there was no language at the time, this was in the 1980s, to discuss this complexity of issues. And it sounds as if there still isn't a language to discuss it. In another area, in the same set of experiences I had, was a shop steward who was himself a diviner healer. And I noticed, I haven't read the book yet, I just bought it, but the role of African cosmology and explanations of their place in the world and how they experience filtered through what in the old days might have passed for traditional notions of traditional meaning, which were still very much present then. I mean, this shop steward at the time owed his power as a shop steward to his status as a diviner healer in the Eastern Cape. So on the one side, there's this transformation that's made up of socialist-inspired organizations, rhetoric, categories, that at no point has been able to grapple with the reality that you're describing, which both in terms of traditional notions of authority and roles, and in terms of sexuality. And the irony is that South Africa is better placed than most societies, given the multitude of institutions and civil society for dialogue, of radio, of the vote, to have this conversation, and yet it seems thoroughly disempowered to do so. And that raises a potential twist, which is a question. Might it be wise that the government doesn't venture into these areas? Because they don't have the language to do it either, but know what sorts of forces they'd be stirring up amongst their ostensible base to begin raising this.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it certainly is responsible for a great deal of government's reticence. Certainly it was responsible for Mandela's reticence. I don't think he could begin to dream about how to talk about these things. It was truly beyond him. There have been a couple of significant changes in language since the 1980s, which may have made things better or worse, I don't know. But one is the discourse of human rights. It's now in the Constitution, it's spoken of, it's in the texture of daily life. And that alone has opened up the private sphere in ways that it wasn't in previous years. you know, with the human rights discourse comes the idea that the private realm is a public place. It's a place where public bodies have an interest in what happens. And, you know, many women have cottoned onto that and speak about it. So, you know, in a sense, there's language which shatters that private sphere, which never was before, and creates, you know, deep crisis there for men. And another thing that's changed, another new language is, I mean, this may seem banal, but I think it's quite powerful, is a language of consumerism, which came with the end of apartheid. I mean, a young black urban person now defines him or herself through the clothes they wear, through their bodies, through sexuality, and that is utterly new in South Africa. That's not how young people defined themselves in the 80s. It was never a consumerist, and now it's a fetish. It's huge. It's certainly what the world of crime is all about. So these languages are there. These languages that you know discuss bodies and gender and sex are there. But in a sense, they're the language through which the problem compounds itself. It's very hard and frustrating to know how to change that language into something productive. And you know, as you can tell from the discussion, I don't know. I think it's very hard.
Let me ask a question to follow on to that, and then I think we should break and have a little reception and continue the discussion. You know, the Kaiser's representative, the Kaiser Family Foundation, has made a major investment in South Africa in the Love Life program. And one of the guiding premises of that program is that you have a hip-hop urban culture that is very media savvy and message savvy, and that you can create a prevention idiom that will connect to youth in South Africa. And it's been a very significant and serious investment that's been made by Kaiser, and like no other place in the world in terms of its priorities outside our borders. And it's been a subject of a lot of discussion and debate, but it's directly relevant to what you're talking about here. And could you offer any comments on that, on the Love Life program, and how that relates to this debate that we're having here today?
I'm very skeptical of the Love Life program. I you know, when I read Helen Epstein's piece, critique of it in the New York Review of Books, I thought, this is what I've thought all the time, but haven't been able to articulate it. I think that prevention means talking about the disease and talking about the fact that it's fatal and that you can die from it. I think that trying to attach prevention to a very sort of stylized identity, a very airbrushed identity, is just another symptom of not being able to talk about it. It's a very loud and very elaborate way of not talking about you know, the transmission of this epidemic.
Do you see any other innovative approaches on prevention that you find more compelling and creative in South Africa?
I'm a little stuck on prevention. I think that whenever I see new speak, I immediately get cynical. I don't see it working. Among the most creative and unlikely things that I've seen is a women's group in Lusikisiki of young women in their late teens and early 20s, and they're all women. There were a couple of men in the group. This was a treatment group. The men were silent and quite humbled and weren't really free to speak. It was very much a women's forum, and They were talking quite openly about sex, and in a Lusikisiki context, that was extraordinary. It was probably, you know, possibly unprecedented. So, you know, what is that forum producing? And towards the end of the discussion, they were going to have a Christmas barbecue, and they were discussing to make arrangements for it. And every comment was, will your boyfriend bring transport? Will your boyfriend bring meat? Will your boyfriend provide money? And there was the problem, sitting right with them, that they were all having transactional sex of one form or another just to get by, because that's what you do there. But that wasn't discussed at all in the women's forum. It was just came out symptomatically at the end. So I'm really struggling. I don't know how you break through and begin to talk about those things. I just haven't seen it done successfully anywhere. Maybe I haven't got out enough, but I haven't seen it done enough.
Go ahead, Scott.
This may not be so quick. I'm going to try to make it really fast. But I had an experience not too long ago with a number of individuals from Namibia who were visiting in Chicago for National HIV Testing Day. And a number of the younger Namibians seemed quite grossed out by consumerism in South Africa and quite determined that their countries would not become like this, or their country would not become like this. We then had there was a reception on like the 77th floor of the Sears Tower, and they were looking out over the city, and you know, I was explaining the concept of the box store because you could see them from way up here in the top of the Sears Tower, and they were utterly grotesque, as you know, grossed out by the concept of the box store, as am I, and you know, I found this fascinating, and in many bizarre ways, you know, as much of an American consumer as I am, you know, I kind of tended to agree with that, like, you know, don't get the bad with, you know, any good that comes from development. But also in this delegation was the permanent secretary from the their Ministry of Health, and when he was asked a question by the Windy City Times, which is a gay and lesbian newspaper in Chicago, about prevention of HIV between men who have sex with men, he said that they have never known of that phenomenon in Namibia, which of course the person from the Windy City Times was quite amused by, as were, you know, a number of us. But I guess, you know, kind of my question is, so can they, you know, can they move beyond, in a country like Namibia, move, and this is broader than just HIV, but move, you know, to the point where they can acknowledge that there is a phenomenon such as MSM and address it without, you know, it seems like it's going to be one or the other. Like, you're going to get the box store and, you know, comprehensive prevention messages, you know, you're going to get them both. You're not going to get one or the other. And it just seemed that, you know, on the one hand, I totally agreed. Yeah, you shouldn't, you know, inherit a lot of the bad that has come with the wealth to South Africa. On the other hand, you know, it would be nice if you're the permanent secretary for the Ministry of Health, who, by the way, lost his job 2 weeks later, but not for that reason, didn't, you know, make such statements. At least, you know, was briefed better when he was in the U.S. So, you know, thoughts?
Well, I don't know. If the health minister said there's no homosexuality, who are you to second guess him? And
well, we've tried that in the United States, but it hasn't worked.
Yeah, I mean, these things are hard to speak about in South Africa, you know, the monster itself with all its consumerism. You know, one of the discussions we really do need to have in South Africa is how people have sex, and we can't. We're nowhere near that. You know, that it's very, very important to questions of transmission. And the whole science of transmission is very murky. And, you know, there have been a couple of projects which ask people these questions, and they generally fall apart, you know, even in private questionnaires. It's very difficult information to gather. So, yeah, you're asking me questions I'm struggling to answer. I don't know where we start having this conversation. It has proved elusive so far, and I don't have an enormous amount of wisdom about where to start.
I think we should break and have a reception here for a few minutes. Johnny, thank you so much. Congratulations on this book.